Today is the first part of a series of talks on relationships. Anytime that we exchange energy, we are in relationship. We are relating to the object of our attention, whether that's us or a thing or another person. Now, it would be nice that every time that we exchanged energy with ourselves and the object of our attention, if both of us gained energy, we both were better off energetically as a result of that exchange. Now, we would call that energy exchange a win-win situation. If we were closed containers of energy, some people think this, you know, we have a body and we have a certain amount of energy in that body, and when we expend it, we fall over dead. So we're like a D battery, and we have this container of energy. So in our exchanges with other people, they are containers of energy too. The game is to try to take some of their energy and prevent them from taking our energy. So we're trying to take from their battery pack, and they're trying to take from our battery pack. And in a situation like that, a win-win outcome is pretty much impossible because somebody has got to lose in a closed situation. Somebody is going to gain, somebody is going to lose. Somebody is going to have more energy, and somebody is going to have less energy. So in a situation like that, if we were a closed system, the best we could hope for in an exchange is, okay, I won't take any of your energy if you promise not to take any of my energy. And so we just kind of bounce energy off of one another, but we don't actually exchange it. And that would be like a stalemate. And so at the end of that, whatever we would call that interaction, we would both walk away with the same amount of energy that we started with. The good news is, of course, that we're not closed energetic systems. We're more like open systems, like how about a fruit tree? A fruit tree would draw energy from its roots into its body, and then take that energy out of the soil, out of the water, the nutrients, and so on, and it would use the leaves to bring in sunlight for photosynthesis, so that light would help in its development, its metabolism, and it would be breathing through its leaves. That's where respiration is occurring primarily. And you go, the plant is drawing in energy, releasing energy, drawing in energy, releasing energy. And we can say, oh yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. A lot of human beings think in terms of material things, obviously, because they're so much easier to identify. So people believe, on one hand, I'm putting energy into my body. I'm using Snickers. I'm using Starbucks coffee. I'm using banana. I'm using broccoli. I'm using Brussels sprouts and other foods like that. That's where I'm getting my energy. And as long as I keep the energy level through the delivery of food and beverages, I'm breathing as well. Okay, so I get energy from the air that I breathe, and I'm okay. The truth is different. The truth is different. While that does provide some energy for the body to use, as Christ says in Christ Returns, most of the energy entering and leaving our bodies is not happening on a physical level. It is not the food and beverage that we're taking in. It's not just the air that we're breathing. You know energetically this experience that somebody says a critical comment to you that hurts, that deflates you. It's like, oh wow, I could feel that. Well, what just happened? What energy exchange just happened? Where did that energy go? On the other hand, we also know that a person turns around and praises us or validates us in one way or another. All of a sudden, we feel more energized. So where did that energy come from? We weren't eating at the time. We weren't drinking at the time. It's that idea, these energy exchanges that occur on levels other than just the physical, are the main parts of relationships. life makes more sense to me, and obviously that's the game here. We're trying to understand life. We're trying to make rules about life so that we're more effective. And I'll deal a little bit with that later on in this talk. But life makes more sense to me when I consider us to be certainly not closed physical containers, but rather I draw us as a with a field of energy around us. Maybe it's egg-shaped. I've heard people express it like that. It's an egg-shaped field of energy around us. Okay, I'm willing to accept that shape. I'm also willing to accept that it extends out from our bodies further than our arms can reach if we were to extend them out to the side. You go, okay. So this energy field around us is, what, us? And I think it is part of our beingness. It is part of our existence. We're not just the stuff inside of the physical container of skin. There's more to us than that. And that more to us than that is this energy field and also our connection to the divine. So now I'm looking at the energy field. I've got this oval field around us. I think it has varying degrees of porosity. Porosity means it's porous, more or less, and depending on the object of our intention or attention, we would look at something, or we would consider something, or we could intend something, and now the porosity, the receptivity, the openness changes based upon whatever that object is. If we're looking at something that is scary, now all of a sudden, the receptivity of that field, of that border of that field, becomes denser, more closed to protect us, kind of like a shell of a shellfish or a turtle. It's like, oh, no, not open, closed to it. If we were filtering water, you could understand this idea of porosity. I'm going to filter water. I'm going to drink some water, but it needs to be filtered. Well, depending on the filter, certain molecules are going to be allowed through. Certain size molecules will come through the filter with no problem because of its porosity is designed this way. But larger filters, you know, catch bacteria, catch, I'll say heavy metals, catch debris and other stuff, parasites. It's like, ooh, nope. We're not going to let those through. So you go, okay, all right, that makes sense to me that a filter would be like that. And depending on the quality of the water, we would make decisions about the filter that we used. We certainly wouldn't want to use a real, like a coffee filter to filter water that we just took out of a mud puddle or an unknown stream. We're like, that's too porous. Too much stuff is going to get through a coffee filter. You're going to want to use something else. This idea of how we would select a filter, really, if you looked and you're in, say, Alaska in some virgin territory, and you're looking at the water running in a stream, you'd go, wow, there's no pollutants up here. This is the quality of this water is probably superb. Let me drink it like this. I don't even need to filter it. I don't perceive any threats. I don't perceive any danger. I can just drink this right out of the stream because it's bubbling up from a spring, for instance. But if we perceived a threat, if it was way downstream and there were other things and now the water is murky or we knew there was some factory between us and its source, we're like, this is dangerous. I need to filter this stuff. The more dangers we have learned to perceive in our lives, the less open, the less receptive our field is going to be. The porosity of our field is going to be less because guess why? I've got beliefs about the danger in life. I know life is dangerous. I know you can't trust people. I know people who say they love you and they're going to take care of you, and then they do just the opposite of that. I have those beliefs. And so we're much less open, much less receptive. Those beliefs actually control us. They control us like they were switches on an instrument panel. And what we fear, what we reject, or what we embrace, and what we let in are all determined by our beliefs based upon our previous experiences. To me, and to you, I'm sure, it's completely understandable that we have been trying to figure out what energies to resist, to avoid, or to let in. I think this starts as early as conception on a physical level and continues our complete physical life until we exit the physical body. And if you look around, maybe even at your own situation, but at others it's a lot easier to see deficiencies in other people sometimes, that you can look and say, you know what I'm noticing? Human beings don't do very well at distinguishing between life-enhancing energies and activities and life-diminishing energies and activities. We let in stuff we don't want to be letting in, and we keep out stuff that we would do well to let in. In other words, our relationship with life needs to be improved. Our awareness of this fundamental concept of what do I let in, and what do I not let in? Physically, we could say, this lifetime, our relationship with life begins at conception. And you can imagine that building materials are being added to us, brought into us, drawn into us by our mother, drawn to us, and we grow physically. Other energies besides the physical building materials necessary to construct our bodies were also added to us by our mother. Her thoughts, her feelings, her words, her actions. The same is true with our connection to our father's energy. You could say, the father, he planted the seed and then got out of bed and went and did his thing. Yeah, you can see it. If you're looking only at the material level, only at the physical level, you could say he's no longer connected to his contribution to the development of the physical body of the baby. But if you're looking at some other level, the quantum level, the energetic level, the spiritual level, you go, perhaps we are always connected to our roots, our fathers, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, and on and on and on. Some people suggest that we are influenced by 7 generations of our parents. Some say 10. Some, I've even heard, think that we are affected by the experiences of 20 generations of our bloodline. That is a lot of thoughts, a lot of feelings, a lot of words, a lot of actions, lots and lots of energy exchanges, lots of experiences. It's not difficult to think that the vibrations we experience while we're in the womb can color our relationship with our future lives outside the womb. If information vibrationally, energetically is being delivered to us, where's that stuff going? It's going into our consciousness. If our mothers were angry or fearful or anxious, we will tend to be angry, fearful, or anxious. If she was peaceful while she was carrying us, relaxed, joyful even, we will tend to be peaceful, relaxed, and joyful. In other words, we were taught how to relate to life before we were even born. Is life safe? I don't know. What did your mother say when she was carrying you? Is life easy? Is it fun? Is it wonderful? Was she looking forward to the future? Let's ask our mothers. And our training didn't stop. Then, our birth experience was a combination not only of our experiences as this little conscious being, and a lot of people go, the baby can't feel things, the baby is not conscious, and so on. They have recognized it, and there's a great book, Awakening Consciousness, that is written by, I think she's a PhD MD, who says, wait a minute. This infant, seconds after being born, is conscious. You can see it when you look in their eyes. You can see it when you talk to them. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? You're talking to somebody who is processing information seconds after birth. Well, if they were processing information before they were born in utero, and they're processing seconds later when they're born and you're looking them in the eye, you think there's any chance they might have been processing information during the birth itself? I think that's a pretty easy answer. That's a big yes. So if we think our birth experience was a combination of our own experiences that we have as a conscious being, whatever our mothers were experiencing, if we were the firstborn, you know there's got to be some level of anxiety and fear of and the unknown. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. This is, I haven't been through this before. In my own case, I was number five. So my mother, she was a registered nurse, clearly knew how babies were born. She knew what that birth experience was. Doesn't necessarily make it any easier, maybe much easier physically, having been through it. However, you still have to make a determination of the mother's attitude. You know, how did she feel about additional responsibility of this baby? That's one of the real challenges, right? Carrying a baby for 9 months, I would think, is real difficult. I've heard the complaints about carrying a baby in the summertime and how difficult it is to walk and the heat and on and on and on. But now the baby is born. It's like, oh-wee, how am I going to take care of this little thing? Can I afford to? Do I have enough energy? Do I have enough time to do this? Do I have the finances to do this? Do I have the mind space, mind share? How am I going to handle all these responsibilities related to this one child? And if I have numerous children, a whole different ballgame entirely. So you go, whoa. Besides us and our mother in the birth process, it is the anxiety level or whatever. That is happening. If they're anxious, and this is interesting, I subscribe to a medical newsletter produced by doctors that it said, you know what the main thing is related to cesarean sections? You know the main cause of cesarean sections? And they've discovered it. The anxiety level of the obstetrician. Like, what about the mother and the baby? No. Anxiety level of the obstetrician. If they're anxious, they're worrying about malpractice, they're worrying about their insurance, they're worrying about doing something wrong. Cesarean section, here we go. It's like, wow. So if you add in the anxiety of the medical staff or a midwife, they tend to be, more reasonable in their attitudes, or anybody else who was participating in that and had thoughts or words or feelings about the birth of that baby, all of that energy combined is delivered to that child. So you go, whoa, conception, in utero, birth. Yeah, and then our training really starts in earnest after we're born. Every time we have a significant energy exchange experience as an infant, as we grow up, when we have these energy exchange experiences, this is what human beings do. We give meaning to those experiences. We make it up. Doesn't have to be factual. Doesn't have to be accurate. Doesn't have to be true. We make up the teaching point of that experience. Now, it's very clear you put your hand on a hot stove. What is the teaching point? Well, it would be wonderful if the teaching point were this. Don't put your hand on a hot stove. Or verify whether the stove is hot before you put your hand on it. But you wouldn't want the teaching point to stay out of the kitchen. Don't use stoves. Stoves are dangerous. Appliances are out to kill you or hurt you. You wouldn't want those to be the teaching point. But all of those are made up. They're all made up. And as we give those meanings, what we're really doing is establishing a rule for life, a programming statement. So in the future, if we use our newly created rule, we could relate to life more effectively. That's the design. like, oh, let me make up a rule that will serve me in the future about stoves, hands, hot. Okay. But if it means stay away from kitchens, you go, yeah, that I don't think that's an effective rule. You don't want that rule to govern your life. But the main problem with children is that when we're on the receiving end of these intense energy exchanges, be they hot stoves or sharp glass or people who are malfunctioning, number one, children aren't aware enough at that point to be establishing rules that are going to govern their lives. For children to start programming their lives at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or even a little later, like, that doesn't sound like a good idea. Two, children don't yet realize we're not the center of the universe. No, I'm the center of the universe. Yeah, yeah. And everything that happens is my responsibility, my fault, my blame. I did it, or nope. Later on, we might get a better idea about that. But as little children, we may think that is true. And then if we look at the people that we're experiencing some of these intense energy exchanges with, it's like, oh, yeah, are they malfunctioning mentally or emotionally or physically? Yeah. And a child goes like, that big person can't be at fault. That's like saying it's God's fault. It must be mine. Must be my responsibility for their behavior. Not so, but that's a programming rule that goes into effect very frequently. And we don't know as children that parents don't have to reflect on us. They're not a reflection of us. And it would be nice if parents understood that their children are not a reflection on them. There's a lot of control that goes on in parent-children relationships, is because, you know, what will the neighbors think if you do that? Well, I don't know. What will the neighbors think if you behave the way you behave? It's like, don't be fresh, little child. Yeah. The point is, individualized consciousness is individualized. They're individualized. We're individualized. But children don't really know that. And for those kids who are fortunate enough to grow up in a harmonious, predictable family, wouldn't that be nice? We can expect them to live life more openly, expecting harmony and predictability in their relationships. Their openness, they're willing to extend their energy, be open and receptive to relationships with other people and things. It's like, hey, I'm familiar with harmony. I know life is predictable. And there's good. I understand that. Yeah. And for the rest of us, however, we might want to go, oh, yeah, I need to go back to the drawing boards and see if I can't heal my relationships. See if I can't establish a more positive view of life that will increase the porosity, the openness, the receptiveness of my consciousness, of my energy field, so more good can come to me. I think that makes a lot of sense. There are lots of very reassuring ideas in the book Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. And letter one, besides reading about how Jesus lived his early life in rebellion and not complete holiness, was very heartening to me. My early life was not complete holiness. My current life is not complete holiness. And so it's nice to know of his humanity. It makes me, and perhaps you, more accepting of your own humanity. But in letter one, in addition to that, his description of his discovery of the nature of God when he was in the desert after he had been baptized by John, and he was in a state of enlightenment, when he, like, I got it. I understand the nature of God. To me, that's the best part. Up to that point, the Jewish priests were saying, well, you know, we control the relationship between you and God. We control it. And so we're going to tell you who that God is. You know, that God is, he's like a really, really huge man. He's powerful. He's jealous. He's just. You know, he's all about punishment. If you're bad, he's wrathful. He's selectively loving because he loves certain people, and the people he doesn't love, look out. And he's vengeful. He's vengeful. And he really demands a huge amount of obedience. And he expects propitiation. And the way to do it is by sacrificing living things. There. That's God. And out in the desert, Jesus went, no. He didn't understand that. And according to the book, he didn't understand that even as a child. But you can think about what kind of relationship could you have with such a being as described by the Jewish priests? What are you up to? Oh, I'm trying to escape punishment. That's what I'm all about, because I know there's a punisher up there on that cloud, you know, with a bad, bad attitude. So I'm trying to escape that. You seem a little anxious. Anxious? I'm terrified, and I'm doing everything I can to hide from that all-knowing, all-present, sees everything, hears everything, knows what I'm thinking, knows what I'm doing. And because he's committed to punishment, and how about the reward? Well, okay, punishment of hell for eternity, and heaven, that's not really clear to me what that is, but what a stressful way to live. In the book, Christ says he rejected that depiction of God and thought it couldn't possibly be true. Well, it doesn't make any sense that that would be true. And he also sensed that this depiction of God was, wait a minute, why are they painting this picture? For the purpose of keeping the average man in fear, in his place, under their thumb, so they could maintain power and control. So the religious elite, political elite, were trying to maintain control and influence over the other people. You go, 2,000 years ago, this sounds awful current. This seems like it's happening right now. So in the desert, his relationship with God changed completely when he understood the true nature, when he could see how God was functioning. And it would be easy for you and I to say, how can you have a true relationship with anybody, a really deep, intimate, wonderful relationship with them, if you didn't know what their true nature was? You'd have to hold back. You'd have to protect yourself. And it's like, yeah. So, knowing the true nature of whatever it is, to include a hot stove or a cold stove, makes having a relationship with it so much easier. So when Christ was out in the desert and he was astonished by the realization that God was consciousness, a purposeful, intelligent energy, actively working on behalf of all of its creations to increasingly provide for their growth, nutrition and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, in a world influenced by rhythms and governed by spiritual law and order, the law of cause and effect, also known to us as we reap what we sow. And when you think of it, it's like, wow, that law of cause and effect, we reap what we sow. What could be fairer than that? There's no favoritism. It's like, you want good, sow good. Then you can harvest it. You want bad? The way to do it is to sow bad. And to sow bad and expect good, it's like, no. We reap what we sow. I think that is so reassuring. And I certainly can, on a small level, appreciate Christ's relief at discovering the true nature of divine consciousness out there in the desert. It's like, wow, phew, what a relief to discover the God that was described to me in the temples by the rabbis and the priests. That's not true. It's all made up. It's a myth. Oh, what a relief. I had the same kind of feeling. Used to be afraid of being struck by lightning for things I said or did or didn't say or didn't do. Like, wow, well, am I going to be punished? because I grew up in a religion of fear and manipulation and myth, like so many. That was wonderful. And so, instead of using the word God anymore, because so many people think it's the big man on the cloud with a bad attitude, he started to use the word in the book, Divine Consciousness, as a different way to express that. Universal consciousness and divine consciousness, more active, supporting creation. Like, the most important relationship is the one we have with our source of being. Without it, we wouldn't exist. Just like, do I need to have a relationship with the thing that brought me into existence? Seems pretty obvious that that's another big yes, right? It's like, if it gave rise to our existence, you know, like, maybe if I understand this power and I deepen my relationship with it, I can experience it more, I'm more aware of it, that could be a good thing. Taking our perceptions that we've developed in our human relationships, and I think this is a big challenge for a lot of people, we see our biological mother and our biological father, and because in most Christian religions they talk about God as a male, God, Father God, period, end of story, it's like, my father is like a god. No, your father is like a human being. God is entirely something different. So superimposing the characteristics of our biological father, that's what God is like, just bigger. Not a good thing. Not a good thing. Because human beings are driven by different influences. And if you can imagine that this energy, this actively moving, intelligent energy that we call divine consciousness or spirit or call it anything you want it, is not driven by human influences, but in fact is really a harmonious, loving, supportive energy for all time, always seeking to deliver those nine items that I mentioned earlier, the growth, nutrition, and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, and with rhythm within the scheme of spiritual law and order. Like, God is not a larger, scarier version of a human man. A lot of people still hooked into that, but it doesn't serve them because it's incredibly stressful. You and I rely on gravity in our daily lives, and you know this, scientists cannot even agree on what gravity is. There are definitions of it and descriptions of it, and physicists that teach in college, still are not sure of which description is accurate for gravity. Gravity. Isn't that unbelievable? But, we're not even sure what gravity is. But we rely on it, and we certainly can appreciate that we have a relationship with gravity when we're effective. Maybe we're a little bit less fond of gravity when we trip and fall or we drop an egg. We're like, oh, wow. Oh, man, that gravity. But most of us realize gravity wasn't trying to punish us, wasn't trying to harm us, wasn't trying to ruin our day. Gravity was just being gravity. It's just an energy pattern that is predictable. Like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Relationships have these two concepts involved in them frequently as their purpose. Giving and getting. Those tend to be the purposes of energy exchanges. Giving and getting. And giving and getting are not necessarily balanced, but they're present anyway. Can understand this idea that divine consciousness is always giving to us, always giving to us, always giving to us, can change the way we think about relationships and how we think about and behave in other human relationships as well. So we look at another human being, and we go, oh, you know, yesterday I was really interested in getting from you, getting energy. But because I am realizing now that the divine is supplying energy to me as much as I want, depending on my receptivity and my openness, and so I'm in a position to give it to you. Can you imagine if people no longer approach other people with this unspoken desperation of, I have to get from this person, I have to get, because we finally understand and experience our source of being. Imagine if we knew that to get what we want, all we have to do is reach out in thought and feeling to our source. All we have to do is open to our source. Anything we want, peace, joy, happiness, ideas that we can convert into money, things that we can do to contribute to the welfare of other people. All we have to do is reach out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness and ask for the enlightenment, the awareness, the answer to questions, the solutions to problems, the means to overcome challenges. That's all. And we've got to be receptive to it. Imagine if we viewed our relationships as a continuation of divine support. Well, since I'm divinely supported in all things, growth, nutrition, nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, and so on, since I'm supported in all of that, you know what I want to do? I want to actively facilitate and support other people and other things, to include the planet. Wow. And we can know that our relationship with the Creator involves that power, that consciousness, that intelligence, because it's working for us, and we can know this. We can know this at a core level, that it is working for us, in us, and through us. Now, if we imagine that our relationships are based upon that truth, it's working for us, in us, and through us, and when we interact and exchange energy with somebody else, this is our chance to support them, to deliver our unique translation of divine consciousness through our own human consciousness to the other person for their betterment. Our lives would be dramatically different, wouldn't they? And so would the other person's. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is a pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. That sounds like the beginning of a very nice relationship. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.